This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Discrimination comes in many forms. Have you ever felt discriminated against because of your age? Often older Americans talk about struggling to find a job or to be promoted. Employment attorney Dan Schwartz will join us to talk about our rights in the workplace. And he'll answer your questions. That's later. Now, why is it common to detest the idea of growing older? Author Ashton Applewhite says we start to associate aging as bad when we're young. She says it's time to embrace aging, and it's one of the messages in her book, This Chair Rocks, a Manifesto Against Ageism. She'll join us coming up. Now, speaking of aging, you've all heard of the midlife crisis. Do you feel like you're in that period of your life now? Each one of us experiences transitions in our lives. Do you believe life improves when we hit middle age? You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, at Where We Live. Now, my guest next believes the idea of a crisis at middle age is not quite accurate. Jonathan Rausch is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of the new book, The Happiness Curve, Why Life Gets Better After 50. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Lucy.
I had mentioned earlier that we're all familiar with the term midlife crisis, but we may not know where that term came from. And I understand that it goes back to the 1960s. Can you give us a little bit of the history?
1965, a psychoanalyst named Elliot Jakes came up with the term midlife crisis, and he meant to describe that in artists and creative people, they come face to face with their mortality, and this kind of shocks them, and there's a big change in their work. And this caught on as a popular culture meme, and it's still caught on.
I understand that he was also describing feelings that he was feeling at the time when he presented this idea to other psychologists.
That I've never heard, but it might be true.
I think we heard that, read that in another Atlantic article. But again, when he brought up this term, midlife crisis, how did it become popularized? Why did people embrace this term?
Well, there was a book by Gail Sheehy called Passages, which embraced the idea of midlife crisis, and it caught on because it has a certain resonance. A lot of people do feel restless and dissatisfied in middle age, and often, as in my case, they don't know where that's coming from because they're meeting their goals. So the idea of a crisis caught on. Unfortunately, it's not accurate.
It's not accurate because it's something that many of us encounter. Tell us a little bit more about how you believe it's more a natural stage of life.
Yeah, so this is the subject of my book, The Happiness Curve, and it arises much more recently out of big data sets all the world over that economists have found. What they've discovered is that aging all by itself, irrespective of what else is going on in your life, has an effect on your happiness, and it fights happiness until roughly midlife, and then it switches sides, and it helps you be happy after that, in late adulthood, right through to the end. But that means there's this transition period in the middle, and people's usually about their 40s, when people are in this long, grinding transition. It's not a crisis at all. It's the opposite of a crisis because it's slow and it's gradual, but it seems like it's never going to end. And people feel restless, dissatisfied. They don't know why. They make mistakes in their life. Sometimes that can cause a crisis, but usually it's just a long, difficult slog.
When we look at this pattern that many people go through, it's not something that's just seen in the Western world. Has this been something that's been documented worldwide, Jonathan?
Yeah, it varies in specifics and how happy people are and when the turning point is by country. But yeah, the pattern of age working against happiness until middle age and then turning around turns up not only in countries and cultures around the world, but a variant of this has also been found in chimpanzees and orangutans who are less happy in midlife than they are either before midlife or after midlife.
Now, when you also write in an article in The Atlantic the story of the U-curve, explain that a little bit more and where that came from, not necessarily from psychologists, but economists?
Yeah. There's a field that's new. It's called happiness economics. It really comes into its own only in the 2000s and late 1990s. And they look at these huge data sets on life satisfaction. Life satisfaction is not the same as, like, mood or cheerfulness. They're not asking, did you smile yesterday? and how often, they're asking, how satisfied are you with your life as a whole? And they looked at, they had millions of data sets, surveys all over the world. So they started looking at that data, and they started controlling for everything, as statisticians do. So they took out the effect of income, education, health, marriage, kids, everything like that they could think of. And then they looked at the data, and they found this weird result. All by itself, age was having this effect on happiness. It was making it harder for people to be happy in middle age. And that's where this is coming from. It's really quite recent. It's like 15 years old.
When did you stumble across this U-curve, and is this something that was reflective of what you were feeling in your life, Jonathan?
Yeah, that's where this came from for me. I'm a textbook case. When I was 40, I started feeling this strange dissatisfaction and kind of feelings that I hadn't accomplished anything worthwhile in my life and restlessness, and I had to change things up. I figured it would go away, but it didn't. It got worse little by little, gradually, but steadily. And then I knew something was really strange, because not only was I hitting all my goals in life, plus some, you know, stable relationship, great career, good health, you name it. When I was 45, I won the National Magazine Award, which for a magazine writer is the equivalent of the Pulitzer Prize. I mean, it's the top award in the entire profession. Well, that made me feel satisfied for about 10 days. And then all of this weird ingratitude and restlessness came back. That's when I realized that what was going on was not rational. It wasn't about my life. It was about something else. A couple years later, a Brookings Institution economist, a colleague, mentioned this U-curve literature, said, you know, look what happens in middle age. I looked at that curve, Lucy, and I said, that is me. That describes my life. And sure enough, in my 50s, these feelings receded, and I've, you know, gratitude comes back. I'm a textbook case.
We know that over time, our life expectancy has changed. It also depends on where you live. But what exactly is midlife? You mentioned at 45 you started to have these feelings. But when are most people bottoming out, so to speak?
The bottom for most people in the U.S. is late 40s, around the age of 50 or so, which is why the subtitle of my book is Why Life Gets Better After 50. But remember, this isn't like a sharp turning point. It's very gradually down, starting in your late mid-30s, even early 30s. And then it's very gradually up. And that's why the crisis idea is wrong. It's not like something sudden is going to happen to you, or you're going to go out and throw away your marriage and do something irresponsible. It's like in your 30s, you're going to notice it's harder to be satisfied, and you have more status anxiety, and you're feeling more restless, and that will kind of quietly grow. But then starting in the 50s, it tends to diminish. And in fact, as we get older, right until the end of life, it becomes easier to feel grateful and satisfied.
This is Where We Live. On the phone with me, Jonathan Rausch, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of the new book, The Happiness Curve, Why Life Gets Better After 50. Today, we're focusing in on the term midlife crisis. Is this something that you felt that you've experienced or know someone in your family that you believe is going through this tumultuous period? We all, again, respond to transition differently in our lives, but you can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We were learning a little bit more about the U-curve, and this is something, again, that economists came up with. What has been the response from psychologists, Jonathan?
Well, at first there was skepticism, but now there's a lot of cooperation and cross-fertilization. And one of the fun things about writing my book is it's really a detective story about how this effect, this important effect of aging on happiness, and very weird effect, not what you'd expect, comes out of economics and then starts to inform psychology, and psychologists begin to figure out an explanation for it. And then even brain scientists get into the act, and brain scientists are figuring out how this works at the brain level. Our brains actually change as we age in ways that make us more positive and less stressed and less volatile and better at dealing with other people.
But you've mentioned that the U-curve and this idea being embraced has happened more over the last 15 years. So if we know that this is commonplace, what kind of supports do we have? Is there emphasis on developing that in this country, Jonathan, to help people, transition?
What a great question. Midlife malaise is not a me problem, it's a we problem. It gets much worse in our society because we expect that, you know, at the age of 50, we should be at the top of our game. We shouldn't need any support at all. Our parents rely on us, our kids rely on us. But who do we rely on? It turns out that midlife is a very vulnerable time because we are experiencing this transition in values from being more focused on ambition when we're young to more focused on connection when we're older. But society gives no help to people in this situation. So we need to do a lot of work to support people in middle age who are feeling this malaise. They're not depressed. They don't need a doctor, but they need outreach and support. They need not to be mocked. Very often we mock people. We say, oh, Lucy must be having a midlife crisis. Well, that is totally the wrong answer.
So give us some examples. You've written about this, Jonathan, about are there examples of, certain types of employers that respond to this? Or I think there was the Stanford Institute for Midlifers, so to speak, this idea of encouraging lifelong learning, helping people kind of reboot, so to speak.
Yeah, we've got some green shoots. Not too much more than that at this point, but we are starting to see civil society respond to the realities of midlife. There's a fascinating program at Stanford, which it's a fellowship where people in midlife at the height of their achievement can go off for a year and study and rethink their lives in conjunction with other people like themselves and prepare for a next stage. Later in life, in the last decades, we're less focused on competition and we kind of want to give back. So an important thing to do is create avenues for people who want to back off of that hyper-competitive, status-oriented career. Stanford is doing that. There's people who are talking about gap years for people in midlife. There's an idea to take some money out of Social Security for a year, kind of advance that so you can use that for additional education in midlife. There's informal groups like the Transition Network, a marvelous group for women in midlife and beyond who are repurposing themselves, and a whole movement called Encore Adulthood and Encore Careers, all of which are telling you what is true. It is wrong that the best is over at 50. The best is just beginning at 50.
This is Where We Live. Join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Lillian's calling from Chester. Lillian, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that midlife was the point where I sort of put down a lot of burdens and decided that the time had come for me to embark on a gender transition, which obviously isn't for everyone, but that process of reassessing myself, rewriting who I was as a person, how the world saw me, looking at what I valued, what I wanted to carry with me from the past, and what I wanted to start new, was a really important way of bridging the space between my youth and post-middle age.
Lillian, I'm curious that you said that midlife was a point when you began to reassess and made this transition. Did you feel like you were supported at that time, or was midlife the point where you thought, I don't need approval anymore with the decisions I choose to make?
It was a little bit of both. I had gotten my life together in terms of family and career and, that sort of sense of stability of the practical aspects of life and relationships and that sort of thing. And at the same time, there was very much this sense of, I'm tired of being the person I'm expected to be when I know that I'm not. I'm going to put that down. It's too heavy to carry anymore, and I'm just going to be who I am. And I don't think I had the sort of confidence or presence of mind to do that when I was younger. I think being the age I was, and I was 40 when this all started, was a very important piece of that, being able to take my own life into my own hands in a way that I couldn't before.
Well, thank you, Lillian, for your call. Jonathan Rauch, did you want to respond to Lillian's story, what she was saying about at the time at 40, she felt that she was able to move forward and not have to wait for others' approval. She had the confidence to move forward, where we may not feel that in our 20s, so to speak.
Well, of course, it's a wonderful story. And these transitions can be transformative at any age. I was 25 when I came out and acknowledged to myself and the outside world that I'm gay. And that was transformative in my life. The advice the book has, apart from the science, which we've been discussing, there's a lot of real stories about people and a lot of advice about how to get through this midlife transition period. And one of the more important things I came away with is, often, midlife restlessness is a great opportunity to make necessary change. But here's the thing. It's a treacherous time because sometimes it's just our age that's making us unhappy. But we're not very good at attributing the causes of our unhappiness. So we kind of thrash around. And sometimes we fix on marriage, or in my case, it was my job. There must be something wrong with my career. Well, there was nothing wrong with my career. So sometimes change is necessary at midlife or any other time, but the advice is this: be careful at midlife. Be careful about the variables one at a time so you don't make a big mistake, and try to avoid a huge disruption. Plan the change carefully. Make sure to consult with other people. Don't throw your life away and just suddenly up and, you know, move to something totally different. Build on your skills and knowledge. Make it logical. I call this leap. If you do that, people can harness this restlessness in midlife and make wonderful transitions.
And before we let you go, Jonathan, I am curious. We talked about how our life expectancy, we're all living longer, but we're also making decisions such as some of us deciding to start families much later in life. How does that change this U-curve, so to speak? Does it change?
I don't think it really does. The hardest thing to get my mind around writing this book is that the happiness U-curve, that's the sort of what economists call the pure effect of aging. That's just what getting older is doing to you. It's making it harder to be satisfied at midlife than before or after. But remember, your mileage will vary. In Lucy's case, there are many other things going on in your life that determine your happiness. So, you know, if you get that dream job, if you have kids, if you get divorced or married, all of these things play into it. The important thing to remember is that ticking away in the background is the effect of time. The clock is actually working on your brain, changing your happiness.
Jonathan Rauch, his new book out May 1st, The Happiness Curve, Why Life Gets Better After 50. He's also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Thank you so much, Jonathan, for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up, does age discrimination play a part in the slump people may find themselves in? After the break, we'll hear from an author who says we all have a part to play in combating ageism. And we want to hear from you, too. Join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Have you experienced discrimination based on your age? You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Email us, wherewelive@wmpr.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Now, why does aging get a bad rap? My next guest says we're all ageists, but we don't need to be. Ashton Applewhite's book gets into how we can break away from age discrimination. The book's called This Chair Rocks, A Manifesto Against Ageism. Ashton joins us by phone. Ashton, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you.
So let's talk about ageism. We're used to hearing about racism and sexism, but what about ageism and how pervasive is it?
It is everywhere. It is stereotyping and discrimination on the basis of age, and it is really the last social prejudice to go largely unchallenged. We have this utterly grim view of late life, which I used to feel the same way when I was in my 50s before I started this project. And when I first stumbled across the U-curve that Jonathan was talking about, that people get happier as they get older, I thought they must have cornered two 80-year-olds and given them a cookie. And these changes, I mean, to me, the takeaway, of course, is not that we are so unhappy in midlife, which everyone knows, but that we get happier with age. And in ageist culture, we live in such a youth-obsessed culture that it drowns it out, framing aging as a problem to be cured, as a disease to be fixed. And aging is not a disease. It's not a problem. It is this powerful, natural, lifelong process that unites us all and that conveys all sorts of positive things, along with the scary stuff that is real, too, that we all know about. But let's hear both sides of the story.
So, Ashton, where does this all begin? Where do we first see this bias and how it's then ingrained in us that aging is bad?
Well, it starts, I hate to say it, but in early childhood, around the same time attitudes towards race and gender start to form, because that's when we start to be bombarded with messages from popular culture, starting with cartoons and children's books, you know, cranky, grouchy Grandpa Simpson, or the placid granny rocking in a rocking chair and not doing much else. And but kids who grow up with their grandparents and people who grow up in villages or surrounded by people of all ages don't become ageist because they understand that the mixing of generations and sharing of stories and ideas is the natural order of things, and it's the way it ought to be, you know, and that ageism in the U.S. has subverted it and cut us off from most of humanity.
What about when we were talking about milestones in the last segment, too, of when many of us reach certain points in our lives? Maybe it didn't drive home to us when we were younger that aging is bad. But what if you're in a situation where you're in your career and you have lots of different things to balance and you're also a caregiver for your aging parents?
Yeah.
How does that play into our beliefs about aging and our fears sometimes that we don't want to grow old because we see what our parents may be going through?
Well, you know, when Jonathan said it was not a me problem, it's an us problem, I would zoom that out. He's talking about how you know, we all need support. I would zoom out even further to say this is a cultural problem. Caregiving is a beautiful and important part of life. What makes it hard is to go it alone without supports. And a culture that refuses to acknowledge the fact that we're getting older, which most of us are so unwilling to even address that and look at both sides of it, is unlikely to address the fact that we're mortal and that none of us are independent ever. We have this idea that I'm going to live alone and nothing's ever going to change and I'm going to not ask for help because that's shameful. Asking for help isn't shameful. We ask for help every time we ask for change for the bus, right? So let's change it to an idea about interdependence all lifelong and take the shame out of it and acknowledge that those are two-way transactions, that we're the helper. I mean, everyone likes to help. No one likes to receive help. By the same token, no one wants to die young, and no one actually wants to be any younger. So if aging is so terrible, let's explore some of those paradoxes and look at the whole picture in all its diversity and variety.
So what led you to become an activist and an author on this, Ashton? What misperception did you have about aging that you went and encountered by looking at the research?
I was afraid of getting old. And so I started a project about older people who work, and within 30 seconds encountered this U-curve of happiness, that people get happier as they get older, encountered the fact that the longer people live, the less they fear dying, encountered the fact that old people were depressed because they were old and they were going to die soon. Older people enjoy better mental health than the young or middle-aged. And I realized that what was drowning out this other side of the picture was ageism, discrimination against older people. I mean, imagine what that U-curve would look like if we didn't live in a society that bombarded us with messages that to age is to become incompetent and ugly and undesirable and useless and you should just shuffle off stage. Longevity is here to stay. There's a lot more oldness than there ever has been. It's here to stay. We need to adapt as individuals and as a society to take advantage of those years as best we can. And that means more opportunities for older people in the workforce and everywhere else.
I'm talking with Ashton Applewhite on Where We Live. She's an activist and author of This Chair Rocks, a manifesto against ageism. You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Before we take some calls, Ashton, I wanted to ask you, when we keep talking about when we become older, but what is the age where people are experiencing ageism, and is it different for men and women?
It is different for men and women. Wonderful question. We experience ageism our whole life long because it is any judgment about a person or group of people based on how old we think they are. So if you look at a young person in your office and you think, oh, I couldn't learn a thing from her, or he, you know, kids are like that, that is ageism. Of course, most of the prejudice in our youth-oriented society is against oldness, if you will. It starts for women in their 20s. I mean, I've seen birthday cards that say, like most other women my age, I'm 29 years old, as though you fall off some cliff at 30. Age discrimination starts to kick in the 30s among educated white guys in Silicon Valley, in tech, which is very ageist. So think about the effects of people further down the food chain, if you will. And the messages just mount up over time, which is absurd because the longer we live, the more different from one another we become, the less valid any stereotype. I mean, all stereotypes are wrong, but to stereotype by age is increasingly stupid as we get older, because the older you are, the less your age says about what you're interested in, what you're capable of, who you are in the world.
There are those who say ageism is one of the most acceptable forms of discrimination. Would you agree, and why is that?
I would say that it is the least examined, because I think the baby boom, of which I am dead center at 65, is and which is a lot more older people, is this huge demographic shift that we are starting to have to come to terms with as a culture and a society, and that is shifting awareness. In my opinion, it's no more acceptable than any other kind of prejudice about something about ourselves that we cannot change. It does enormous damage. It pits the generations against each other, which is totally stupid, because the things that make a society or a workplace better to be old in are the same things that make it good for everyone else. You talked about caregiving responsibilities. Well, think about if there was, subsidized caregiving and flex time in workplaces, and all these places were accessible, and there was decent and affordable public transportation and preschool. That helps everyone across the life course. If your kid is looked after, it's easier for you to stop in on your mom. It's easier for your mom to look after your kid or your dad if she can get there by public transportation, if she doesn't feel like driving, et cetera, et cetera. It is a more humane and workable and profitable society for everyone.
You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Frank is calling from Bethany. Frank, go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I'm 45 years old, and for the last 5 years, I have been going from filler job, part-time job to part-time job. I worked for close to 20 years in professional graphics, digital graphics, and what I've feel like I learned a lot from just listening to your guest, and I feel like there are a lot, regardless of age, there's a lot of unconscious and inherent biases in our job market, in our hiring manners. I urge you to do another show on that. There's a lot of bias and discrimination that's just built into the system. My comment is that I believe there is a lot of, as your guest said, unconscious age discrimination. And on the part of corporate America, there's about a little bit of conscious financial decision-making, in my opinion, where I noticed the job denials I've gotten often say they're hiring people with more relevant experience, which is to me like code word for we're hiring younger people that they think are like on the cutting edge of things, which is completely disregarding my 20 years of experience and my knowledge and experience.
Well, Frank, thank you for your call. In studio with me is Dan Schwartz, employment law partner at Shipman and Goodwin in Hartford and Stamford, Connecticut, also publisher of the Connecticut Employment Law Blog. Dan, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you, Lucy. Nice to be here.
I wanted to ask you to respond to Frank from Bethany talking about how in the job market, specifically in the corporate world, you're experiencing this discrimination, feeling like they're looking for younger workers.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see the age discrimination law sort of develop over time. Federal law has been around for decades now that really prohibits discrimination for anyone over 40 years or older. State law prohibits discrimination on any basis of age. So, those claims have been out there, and I think where they have merit is particularly where people can show that people are relying on stereotypes. You know, the notion of you can't teach an old dog new tricks, stereotypes. If those are pervasive in the workplace, that's really where the issues lie. And when you look at the individual characteristics of a person, look at their individual experience, what they bring to bear, that's when employers are on much more solid ground on things.
We also got a tweet from a listener, Martin, who writes, I went for an interview at J.P. Morgan years ago and ended up spending 4+ hours there. Towards the end of the interviewer pulled me aside and whispered, they'll never hire you. You're too old. Martin writes, I was 28.
Someone from the Gen X generation, that seems a bit depressing myself on that. But what we have seen is, despite the efforts to sort of eradicate it I agree in some ways with Ashton that it remains somewhat pervasive. You know, there was just a New York Times report last winter, we can direct your listeners to, where they were showing that companies were using Facebook ads that were directed to individual age groups of, say, 25 to 35. So the only people who were seeing those ads were younger workers. And that's just prohibited by law. It's not what we should be doing. And yet it still exists out there.
Ashton Applewhite's with us again, author of This Chair Rocks, A Manifesto Against Ageism. Ashton, can you talk a little bit more about that as well, about how in the workplace sometimes it also doesn't work in favor of someone who may be in their 20s, who someone looks at and says, well, you're not old enough to have the experience we're looking for.
Right. I mean, ageism does cut both ways. There is tons of research that shows that mixed age teams are the most effective, which is intuitively obvious. You know, different people at different ages bring different skills and experience and aptitudes to the project or to whatever it is. I mean, I'm glad that Facebook screening of ads, you know, that is discrimination of the most blatant sort. And so we do have to look at our own internal bias and not let this message that to age is to lose value as a human being, because it's really that basic and that ugly, take hold of us, because it's incredibly disheartening. I mean, I heard that in Frank's voice, to be told that you cannot get employed simply because you have gotten really good at the thing you are seeking to continue to do. Something is profoundly wrong with society at the basic level if experience has become a liability. I'm haunted by a quote from a Technology Review story about ageism in tech, in which a young guy was getting Botox. He had a key interview, and he said, I can't look like I have a mortgage and two little kids. Mm. Something's wrong with the world where having two little kids disqualifies you for employment.
Before I take a call, I just wanted to ask Dan Schwartz, who's here, if we know there are workplace protections, there are federal laws, there are Connecticut laws. If we know that there are laws in place, why is it still pervasive? Where are the gaps?
You know, I think that for individuals, bringing lawsuits and raising those issues to the consciousness is difficult. No one wants to be seen as the troublemaker, and yet it is only by shining a light sometimes on those issues that we can get to the heart of it. And one need only look at the Me Too movement to show, hey, hadn't we gotten rid of sexual harassment in the workplace. And what we're finding is it's far more pervasive than people wanted to acknowledge. So I think as we continue to shine a light on the issue and raise it and hear the stories of people like Frank on the phone or others to understand that we still have to eradicate this bias in the workplace. You know, I think the ones that succeed, the companies that succeed, do have that diverse workforce, have been bringing people back in who maybe are doing a second career because they want to and because they have the skills to do so. So it's a pervasive problem that needs more attention to it.
Join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Jonathan's calling from Middletown. Jonathan, go ahead.
Hello. I've had experience with ageism personally, and I'm concerned about how much it's becoming built into the current economic status. I'm an economist and general scientist, and I was a principal scientist at a mature startup in the Bay Area. It was odd. I'm now 75, and at that time I was 63, 4 something, and I was about twice the age of the median of the people in the startup, and probably at least 15 years older than the oldest person other than myself. And came the crisis of 2008, they somehow managed to have my position simply evaporate because I was expensive and clients didn't want to pay for anything that wasn't kind of directly contributing to the bottom line. And then at age 65 at that point, it was virtually impossible to find another place of professional employment. That's just personal background. But my specific concern is things that's happening. IBM is a particular example. They, in their corporate rebound recently, they have had a systematic policy of kind of constricting the opportunities of their senior, very seasoned staff because they're very expensive, and essentially guiding them into involuntary early retirement and replacing them with much cheaper new tech people not long out of school. So that a big part of IBM's profitability has come from this intentional restriction of opportunities for older people.
Jonathan, I'll ask author Ashton Applewhite to respond. The economic side of ageism, Ashton, where older workers who are more experienced feel like they're getting and are getting pushed out because they aren't as they are more expensive than the younger worker.
For one thing, it's a fallacy that older workers take jobs away from younger workers. It's been debunked by economists countless times. It's called the fallacy of the lump of labor. The lump nature and amount of labor is not fixed. Greater employment among older people actually correlates to greater employment among younger people. So it's not a zero-sum thing. IBM was recently, ProPublica did a major expose of systematic ageism on the part of IBM. So hopefully they will get the EEOC, Equal Opportunity Employment Commission, will take this on as a lawsuit because it is not legal and the costs are tremendous. A lot of older people don't want to work full time. So that's a way to cut down on those expenses. There are also lots of innovative ways to accommodate those workers. I just read the idea that older workers could stop if you paid into, this is just a proposal, but if you've been paying into Social Security for 40 years, you could stop paying in. Your employer wouldn't match it. It would be a raise for you and a savings for the employer. There are many, many, many ways to skin this cat so that workers of all ages can remain in the workforce.
Let's fit in one more call. Wendy from Colchester. Wendy, we have under a minute. Go ahead with your comment.
Yes, hi. I was just calling to add to the conversation. I have two sisters who are, my older sister is 62, my younger sister is 56, and my older sister, her division was eliminated in her job in Norwalk, and she couldn't find a job for more than $10 an hour, and she was making around $80,000. My younger sister this past year has been interviewing for a year, and as far as I can see, to avoid the ageism accusation, what I see happening is companies just refuse to call you back to let you know if you got the job or not. You can't point your finger at anything when they do that. You can't prove anything when they do that. And she couldn't find a job. The one she finally got is a division of another company she worked for, and she's working for them, getting paid what she was getting paid six jobs ago. And that's really bad.
Wendy, well, thank you for your comment. Before we head to break, Ashton, what companies, who's pushing back on this, on ageism? Is there a movement growing?
There is absolutely a movement growing. I just wrote my latest newsletter was all about that. Australia is launching a national anti-ageism campaign. The World Health Organization is launching a global anti-ageism campaign because ageism is a major issue in health. Study after study shows that people with more positive attitudes towards aging develop less dementia, walk faster, heal quicker. So the way we think about aging has very tangible effects on our mood and how our bodies function and how, as a society, we are going to take care of each other and ourselves as we all age in greater numbers. So a movement is underway. In New York, there's the Radical Age Movement. Come to my website, thischairrocks.com, and look at resources, and you'll learn about all the other people who are working in this arena doing fantastic stuff.
Ashton will tweet out that link at Where We Live. Ashton Applewhite, activist and author again of This Chair Rocks, A Manifesto Against Ageism. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. With me, still in studio, is Dan Schwartz. He's going to stay with us after the break. We're going to learn more about our rights in the workplace. He's an employment law partner at Shipman and Goodwin in Hartford and Stamford. Also has a blog, Connecticut Employment Law Blog, and our number, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. My last guest helped us understand why ageism exists and the harm it can do. Have you experienced discrimination where you work? You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. In studio with me is, again, Dan Schwartz, employment law partner at Shipman and Goodwin in Hartford and Stamford, and publisher of the Connecticut Employment Law Blog. If you could just briefly, Dan, explain to us how the federal protections are a little bit different than what we have here in Connecticut for employees.
Yeah, so federal law has had this law called the Age Discrimination in Employment Act, and it says that you can't be discriminated on the basis of age. But in order to qualify for that, as I was hinting before, you have to be 40 years or older. Connecticut doesn't have that. Connecticut, in a lot of ways, we have broader protections than federal law. And so Connecticut law just says you can't be discriminated against on the basis of age. So you can't discriminate in favor of an older worker versus a younger worker in Connecticut too. The laws change based on federal and state, but the core of the issue is age shouldn't be a factor in your decisions.
We had a caller talk about after the recession. What did you see in terms of the amount of people contacting you related to discrimination complaints?
Yeah, so what we saw in the recession, if you look at the EEOC statistics, they really spiked up to about 25,000 nationwide in 2008. And that's sort of consistent. When people have more difficulty finding a job, we tend to see more claims. But if you contrast that now with 2017, the amount of age discrimination claims filed last year was down to about 18,000, so a drop of over 20% or so. Does that mean we're 20% better in age discrimination? Probably not, but it does mean that when people can find jobs more easily, the unemployment rate being lower, people tend not to file the claims as well. But what we've also been seeing is a sort of renewed emphasis in workplaces to training, to making sure that compliance with the law is there. And hopefully that's having some impact.
Now, what's causing companies to do that? Is it because of Me Too, which you mentioned earlier?
Yeah, there's no doubt that over the last 6 to 9 months or so, we have seen a huge spike in the number of companies who are asking us to do trainings or sending their employees to trainings. And I think they're reevaluating what is the training that we're doing. I think there was a tendency maybe for cost savings or otherwise of thinking that the sort of online computer push button training was good enough. And what we're still finding is the quote-unquote old-fashioned in-person trainings where people can ask questions, where there can be some interaction, has tend to be more effective, and where there's follow-up and follow-through with companies on compliance, I think we're seeing more of an impact with the training.
When someone takes the step, you mentioned there are sometimes hesitancy to accuse an employer of, you know, violating certain workplace protections or feeling like they've been discriminated against. When they do file that claim, is there success?
You know, it's hard to define the success. If you actually look at the EEOC statistics, something like 60% or 70% of those claims are found to have no reasonable cause. Well, the flip side of that is there are still a whole bunch of claims that get settled that have some reasonable cause or some findings to them. And so what we really see is a mixed bag. There are certainly those claims that continue to have merit that get filed. But where that success rate is going to rise and fall just sometimes depends on the economy and the overall number of claims being filed.
If someone ends up leaving their position because of this situation, does that count against them? Are there protections so that their future employer may not know that this came about with its accusations against their boss?
So, you know, lawsuits that get filed in court become public records, and that can tend to be a factor that people might say, oh, I don't really want that out there, because with computers and those records being publicly available, it can be a challenge. And I've heard from people that have said, hey, look, I filed this claim 10 years ago. It was a bad situation. What can I do? And there aren't really great options for those people. You can't sort of wipe the court records clean. And as we're finding, online records tend to be very pervasive and long, even if they're incorrect at times. So that's the balancing act that people have to face.
When we talk about companies doing these trainings, we assume that they have robust HR departments. But not everyone works for companies that may even have an HR person. And so what recourse does someone have if they work for a very small employer and it might just be, you know, and that there's issues? I mean, who should they reach out to for help?
Yeah. You know, it's easy as an employment lawyer to say, oh, just go to HR or go to your manager. But when the manager is the one who might be discriminating against you, that's a challenge for that person. I think there are certainly lawyers out there who can help advise people. There are plenty of good reputable attorneys who do this as a life's work. There are also referral hotlines that a lot of bar associations sponsor. The Hartford County Bar Association has lawyers in the greater Hartford area who are willing to take those calls on a referral. And if you can't afford an attorney, there are legal aid pro bono groups and the Greater Hartford Legal Aid, wonderful organizations, and workers' rights clinics at some various universities who will take those claims.
That's good to know. And Dan, before we end the show, we were talking a lot about ageism. Do you believe that movement's growing to combat age discrimination?
You know, I've been practicing employment law for quite a while now, and you know, it's as I've gotten older, I sort of, you know, like a lot of us, I start to see the issue differently. I always thought my dad was old at the age that I am now. But I think, you know, with the baby boom generation and Gen X sort of coming now into the workplace, hopefully we'll see that change. I think it just takes time.
Dan Schwartz, again, employment law partner at Shipman and Goodwin in Hartford and Stamford, publisher of the Connecticut Employment Law Blog. Dan, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks again, Lucy.
Today's show produced by Lydia Brown. Special thanks to Kate Tolarski, Carmen Baskoff, and Kion Wolf. Learn more about the show at WMPR.org/where we live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Thanks for listening.